good is Australia?
This fucking language.
Let there be a thousand blossoms blooms, as far as I'm concerned. You know, but I ain't spending any time on it.
Don't stop wearing the Speedos.
You're listening to Decode, the Batuta Advocates podcast series for those Australians who have tuned out or never tuned in to the dark arts of politics.
It's called being, you wouldn't believe it, a goddamn bloody adult.
Hello and welcome back to Decode, the Batuta Advocates political podcast series where we try and delve in to what happens in the world of politics here in Australia and in Canberra, all around the country. We like to try and figure out what's happening, what's going on, and we like speaking to people involved in the world of politics, understandably. We're excited today. We've got Max Chandler Mather, who's the member for Griffith and the Greens spokesperson on housing and homelessness, but he was one of the members of the Green slide a few months ago, caused quite a stir. We wrote quite a few stories about it in the Batuta Advocate, didn't we, Dave?
Absolutely, yep. About those peace-loving hippies up in Queensland.
Yeah. We really showed the rednecks down south. But we've got him on the podcast. Max, thanks very much for dialing in today.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
It's been a little while now. The dust has settled on that Green slide we just mentioned, which was obviously a historic moment for our great state. Your party picked up three seats, and that really made a statement, as we said, to those rednecks down in New South Wales and Victoria. They've only got one, I think. They've got Adam Bandt in the lower house.
Yeah, that's right.
One MP, that's it. It's all about Queensland. That's the future of the Greens here. But yeah, we were just wondering what the reaction was like from all of the hippies here in Queensland after that Green slide.
There was a lot of people, that's right, the hippies in Queensland, that's right, all the bleeding heart progressives. Although I will say that I've long held that Queensland, ever there was going to be a big growth in the Greens, it was always going to happen in Queensland because, you know, we are the sort of anti-establishment state. We have a healthy suspicion of political authority, and I think that manifests in rejecting the major parties when they're letting people down. But the reaction was a mix of, actually the most surprise came from outside of Queensland, like down south. You know, there was this sort of shock because there's this southern view of Queensland that, you know, sees it as this right-wing backwards state, which I think is just completely wrong. Like having spoken, you know, I've spoken to thousands, not tens of thousands of Queenslanders now over the last few years and lived here all my life. And actually it's as I said, it's far more just this sort of anti-establishment state. And everyone a lot of people in the electorate weren't surprised at all, actually. There was a lot of people who sort of came up to me afterwards and said, oh, no, I saw this was coming. So the reaction was also, I think, excitement and a little bit of, you know, looking forward to the future and thinking, well, this is something changed. Like our slogan during the election was nothing changes if nothing changes. And I think there was a bit of relief that finally something had broken free of the sort of Labor and Liberal Party, which people had both felt like had moved too close together and largely become disconnected from their lives.
Yeah, and I think down in Sydney and Melbourne, they both perceive themselves as the centre of the universe and it's much easier for them. They like putting Queensland and Queenslanders in a box, you know, just a redneck state up north where you go for a nice holiday. But Queensland's so much more than that. There's so many different communities, so many different pockets, so many different types of people. And as you said, anti-establishment may have something to do with a certain premier that ruled the state for quite some time.
Yeah, well, not everyone has been too happy about the Green slide there. Your predecessor, Terry Butler, has had a few things to say. Do you ever, after a long day and some hard work, sit back with a beer and scroll through her tweets?
No, I mean, my philosophy is to not get involved in that sort of stuff. You know, I can understand feeling a bit frustrated if you end up losing the seat. So leave my predecessor and the predecessors of Brisbane and Ryan as well, the other two federal seats, you know, get on with their lives and go enjoy them.
But, I don't know if they're getting on with their lives. Seems to be a lot of sulking on the internet, but like that's some good advice for them to try and move on and get on with their lives. What have the last few months been like since you were elected? Obviously, new job, exciting, spending a lot of time down in Canberra. What's it kind of look like? How much has your life changed?
It's quite significantly. It's pretty hectic. Like you spend 18 to 20 weeks of the year down in Canberra. So lots more plane trips. I think there's something weird about, you know, because you go down into this building down in Canberra and you're sort of stuck in there from like, you find your days start at like 7, you get in there into into the building at like 7:30 in the morning. You often don't leave until like 7 o'clock at night just because so much is going on while you're down there. But it is definitely odd being in a room with lots of people who you know, quite strongly politically disagree with. You know, there's like hundreds of Labor and Liberal staffers and MPs wandering around this very odd, quite isolating building. So that's definitely a peculiar experience. Also, just sitting through question time is just one of the most brain-numbing, boring, but also equally enraging things I've ever been through. My colleague and I, Libby Watson-Brown, were sitting there wondering, oh, what are the combined, you know, what are the combined salaries of everyone in this room? And like, how much money is this wasting the public per minute? But as I was going to say, the other thing is that there's a lot of positives as well. Like, you get to meet lots of wonderful and interesting people. You know, you get a platform to speak about a lot of the things that matter to people's lives and fight for those things that we're fighting for during the campaign, you know, like dental into Medicare, tackling the housing crisis and climate change. And you get a lot more resources to do that stuff as well, which is, that's the very much the enjoyable part.
Yeah. And I mean, it's nice for us to interview someone who's a bit closer to our age rather than almost double our age. What's it been like being one of the youngest members of parliament? Do you get treated a bit differently? Is it kind of...
Yeah, definitely. Definitely treated a little bit differently. You know, I think everyone's had that experience of being a bit younger and not being talked down to, but maybe just not, you know, seen in the same light as they say if you're in your 50s or 60s. Like a lot of people down in Canberra. But, you know, obviously people in their 50s and 60s also have a lot of life experience as well. So, yeah, it's also, it's definitely a bit odd just being in a place where lots of your fellow MPs definitely aren't your age. But thankfully, you know, there's a lot of people I get along with down there who are a variety of ages. But, yeah, you definitely find yourself being treated a little bit differently. But to be frank, I often find that that's a useful thing, you know, like if you're seen as inexperienced and underestimated a little bit, that's a lot better than people overestimating you. So I find that somewhat useful.
Yeah. Life experience is something I'd expect you'd be hit with quite a lot, which, I mean, how do you take that from career politicians who've potentially just been in politics for, you know, 20 or 30 years?
I don't really pay much attention to it because I suppose my view is that as a political representative, really your job is to take the life experiences and views of everyone in your electorate down to Canberra. I'm not there to go and run my own little personal vendetta or anything like that or my own personal views. And one of the things I found during the campaign was, you know, every day I would go out knocking on doors. And I think in the end, I personally ended up knocking on 15,000 doors and having thousands of convos along with our campaign, which ended up, you know, having 90,000 or over conversations. And I found that was the that's what I feel like I'm taking down there, which is the life experiences of lots of other people, the people I'm meant to represent. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a bit rich when you see some people with like, down there who've been in politics for, say, like down in Canberra for like 20 plus years. But then I think the reason they're disconnected from their people are because precisely they don't do that proactive outreach and they aren't actually connected to the communities they represent, regardless of their backgrounds.
Yeah, quite a step count by the sounds of it. 15,000 doors would have been some good numbers on the health app. Who, you just mentioned there's some people you get along with. Who's good value? Whose company do you quite enjoy in between work?
Well, all my Greens colleagues down there actually have all been super welcoming and nice, which is great. I mean, sitting on the crossbench is interesting because you like sit near people like Bob Katter, who I strongly disagree with some of Bob's politics. But the nice thing about people like that is he's also willing to say when he agrees with you and publicly say it and seems actually quite down to earth. And other people like Andrew Wilkie, who's an independent senator down in Tassie. So you meet lots of people who are, you know, like, very welcoming and nice and don't feel like they're above it all, you know, actually up for a chat. And so that's pretty good. But yeah, there's definitely a few people down there outside of the Greens who I get along with. I haven't found much love from any of the Labor MPs so far, but I suppose there might be obvious reasons for that.
Yeah, it seems like it's been testy.
Yeah, and I think the feeling's mutual from the other side there as well.
Maybe I'm naive to say, but I was surprised at the start just the level of hostility. But, you know, I suppose that's a sign that we're putting pressure on them around not tackling the cost of living crisis or rolling over for big corporations.
Yeah, that's something we want to ask about in a little bit about working with the Labor Party and how negotiations have been. You spoke about a lot of friendly colleagues down there in Canberra. There has been a significant change in the Greens party room over the last little while. Lydia Thorpe is not sitting with you guys anymore. How's that process been?
Yeah, tough. It was very sad to see Lydia go. And actually, she, when I first got into the Greens, was very welcoming and kind to me. So I always felt like she had made me feel welcome from the start, which was nice. So it was sad to see someone who'd sort of like welcomed me into that party room go. And actually, she'd always been one of the ones who it kept being like, yeah, go, Max, keep pushing more on that, on, you know, fighting for renters and things like that. So having said that, with I still got a good working relationship with her. But yeah, no, of course, it was a moment of upheaval and a tough thing to go through, especially in your first 6 months in the job.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, as the Greens party grows, I mean, we've seen a huge growth at the last election and it's kind of been consistent throughout the last 10 years. How do you keep the Greens from becoming just another one of those major parties who are always fighting with factions internally? You know, as the numbers grow, do the factions grow as well, or is it still as united as when it was just one or two of you in there?
That's a great question, and also one that I think is really important, as you said, for as the Greens get bigger. And I think part of it is that having spent a bit of time in the Labor Party in my youth, one of the big differences is there's much more of a culture of open and frank conversations with everyone in the room. And I think that helps, you know, and actually airing disagreements and doing it in a mature way, rather than going back to separate groups and trying to like organize against each other. Certainly I haven't experienced that down in Canberra. So I think maintaining that culture is important. The other big question is like, how, as you become a big party, do you not end up just becoming as disconnected from reality and from ordinary people as the major parties are? And I think that for me is an even bigger question. And certainly on the ground here, we're trying to keep up our door knocking and town hall forums and trying to maintain that connection so we actually do the job of being a representative and not retreat back into Canberra and just into political life, which often people justifiably feel pretty alienating.
Few schooners down at the Storybridge Hotel, does that help, or getting around the community that way?
Yeah, we have these things called pop-up offices, and basically like you set up, we'll let people know in advance and I'll set up at a cafe, right, at like 8 o'clock in the morning for a few hours, and anyone can come and chat to me about anything. And we were getting pretty good turnouts, and then we were like, well, maybe we need to give other people an opportunity to come at a different time. So we created what's called a pub up office. We set up at the Stones Corner Hotel for the first one, and it was the busiest one we've ever had. Like the number of people just coming and grabbing a beer and sitting down and chewing my ear off was like doubled or tripled compared to cafes. So
yeah, love that. Was there anyone who'd kind of been stewing on something and you could see that by the fourth or the fifth schooner, they're like, right, I'm going to go and talk to him about this?
There was definitely some people building up some courage, you know, to outline some interesting plans for the country. But no, actually everyone was very respectful. It was just about, I was sitting there, it was like 6:30 at night or like six or seven, sitting there with a beer, just chatting to someone about housing. And like, I was like, damn, this is a pretty good part of the job, you know, like feeling quite relaxed. And so, yeah, beers down at the Storybridge Hotel sounds like a good place to do it next.
Certainly sounds a little bit different to what, say, major party politicians tend to do. It's more when they go to the pub, it seems to be photo opportunities, and the journalists are there getting all the snaps of them pretending they don't hate the sip of a schooner, the local pub. But anyway.
Yeah, pretending they know how to pour a beer behind a bar and yeah.
Yeah, pretending that's where they actually do spend most of their time.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it's good to know that the Greens are still keeping in touch with the local community. We spoke about before how much the Greens have grown in the last 10 years. Where do you see it going from here in another 10 years' time? Are you guys going to be, you know, dominating one side of the house, or will it be still seen as that third party behind Liberal and Labor?
Great question. I think certainly I see the party growing very quickly over the next 10 years and winning more lower house seats, especially on the model that I think we've pioneered in Queensland, which is, you know, recognising one of the mistakes broadly left progressive politics has made in the past is it's sometimes been very preachy and moralising, you know, like browbeating people and telling them, you know, you're a bad person if you don't think a particular way, et cetera. And one of the big model shifts we made in Queensland was, you know, that big door knocking based model where it's like, what if we just try and talk to everyone in the electorate, find out what they care about and see if we can reach some sort of common ground and, you know, and talk about dental into Medicare or capping rent increases or whatever. So certainly we're going to keep expanding and that model to other parts of the other parts of Queensland and the rest of the country. And I think on that basis, you're going to see a lot a lot more seats turn green, if nothing else, because I think people still feel pretty fed up with the major parties. You know, this federal election, Labor may have formed government, but their vote went backwards, their primary vote. So, and, you know, one third of the country now doesn't vote for the major parties. And I think you're going to keep seeing that happen. And as long as the Greens, as a party, we continue to make that real effort to reach out to people, I think we're going to keep growing.
What were the conversations like in regards to that change that you just spoke about? Find that really interesting. Like in the past, you know, rightly or wrongly, people may have had perceptions about the Greens basically being essentially a legalised cannabis party. You know what I mean? A party with kind of fringe ideas and different sound bites and more of that kind of what, you know, people would say woke ideological kind of stuff. Where did the change happen where you guys decided that you were going to look more broadly at the community and start focusing on more kind of broader policies that people were speaking to you about in the community? How did that come about?
Probably the first time we started that sort of systematic approach when I was managing Jono's council campaign in the Gabba ward in 2016. And no one really expected we were going to win, and we won with this massive like 14% swing. That was the foundation. And then I think after that, we just kept expanding that. And one of the really interesting things I found was the more we based our campaign models on reaching out to people and having these long form chats and chatting anything about their lives or the things they care about, that changed our politics as well. Like I've always described it as the electorate and the Greens as a party both move closer together. And if you're having a chat with someone and you're like, they might really, on the face of it, really care about climate change, but then you're like, well, you know, I'm also struggling to make ends meet. And you're like, oh, well, you know what? It's fair enough that before caring about climate change, you need to worry about how you put food on the table or cover the rent. Or, you know, we mentioned dental into Medicare and they're like, well, I haven't been to the dentist in 5 years and that's a real problem. You're like, well, you know what? That makes enormous sense that you think that needs to be tackled first. And so I think that also changed the mindset of a lot of people in the Greens as well, which is like, you know, the Greens aren't just an environmental party. We have four pillars. One of them is economic justice. So, you know, it makes sense that we also need to focus on those things that the major parties are ignoring. And so I think that shifted a mindset in the Greens as well over time is the more conversations we had.
That certainly sounds like it's working as well. You're speaking about working with Jonathan Tree there, the councillor in Brisbane. Was that something you guys were speaking to head office about, or was that something you pioneered and you guys came up with and then obviously it worked and you spread it throughout the party? Or, yeah, what was the process behind that?
Sort of a combination of both. We had been inspired by Adam Bandt's campaign in 2010, Adam's breakthrough campaign then when he won the seat of Melbourne. And I think we took that as a basis and we sort of innovated off that. And so, yeah, we trialed a lot of new things, you know, much longer form conversations, you being like, oh, well, if we go to someone's door, like, why don't we start to ask about just how their lives are going outside of politics? And that often was very productive. So it was taking that as an inspiration, then I think innovating over time and then sharing that with more and more people was sort of the process there. And, you know, we even got down to, in about 2017, we realized, oh, we should probably be providing training to our volunteers. So we would provide these like day-long, we still do, and they're even more sophisticated these days, but day-long training sessions to hundreds of volunteers. Basically, I've said before to the media, sort of training them to be social workers, you know, like how do you have these longer form chats respectfully? How do you make sure that you record, you know, get information and from people that's useful and relate to their lives in a meaningful way and have open-ended conversations where you're not just telling them what you think. Believe it or not, that takes a bit of training. And I think that we've got better at that over time as well.
Yeah, I was wondering as well, those conversations you're talking about having with people, the Greens quite often, same as the Labor Party as well, might get branded with words like, you know, communism and socialism and Marxism and all that sort of stuff by the Sky News culture vultures. And that seems to be obviously a very easy thing for people in that traditional media to brand the Greens with. It's an easy word that they, you know, if they do know what it means, they are using it obviously disingenuously, or they just don't know what it means. They like to throw that out. I'm assuming you would be hearing that feedback on the streets. How do you have those conversations and navigate that by saying, well, calling for free dental actually isn't communism? That's not really what we're talking about. We're just talking about healthcare here.
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. Honestly, once you get face-to-face with someone, you can break down a lot of those cultural barriers because they're like, oh, the person I'm talking to isn't a raving loony. They actually just want to, yeah, get dental into Medicare. And the VAS, we find maybe the best way to illustrate it is this conversation I had. I remember back in 2019 with this guy, and I knocked on his door and he was like, oh, mate, you won't like me. I think that Campbell Newman was too left wing. And we were like, damn. I was like, damn, okay. And we started chatting and I was like, oh, so, well, you know, I was like, whatever, mate, we don't have to agree on everything, but I wonder if you're interested in any of our policy platform. One thing we think is that we shouldn't be selling off public assets. You know, we think we should be bringing the assets that have been sold off by the government back into public hands. And he was like, oh yeah, no, I agree with that. Completely agree. And we're like, oh yeah, cool. And I was like, well, the other thing we think is that, you know, those big multinational corporations that don't pay any tax, they should pay tax and we should use that to fund bringing dental into Medicare. And he was like, oh, I agree with that as well. And I was like, well, you know, mate, the reason we're here is because the media tell a story about the Greens that's probably not true. And welcome to ask me any questions. And this is what we're fighting for. And we had this great chat after that. And it turned out, you know, he'd been a Boilermaker in the 80s and 90s for a variety of reasons. Yeah, he felt betrayed by the trade union in the 90s. And as a result, he just got disillusioned with politics and decided to vote for the Conservatives from there on in. And the first time, after having a chat with him, I asked him, oh, you know, talking through all this, could you see yourself voting Greens this time? He said, you know what, I think I can. And politics, when it's framed in these cultural ways, as he's described by these cultural vultures, is really hard to shift people's minds. But one of the things that gives me a lot of hope, actually, is conversations like that, because it's like, you know what, if we can reach people and actually meet them where they're at, there's a lot more that we agree on than disagree on. So people, it's up to other people to describe what our politics are, but it just happens that we want to tax big corporations and use it to give things people that need to live a good life. And I'll let the Sky News and Kira Males of the world decide what that is. But ordinary people know that it's just like basic good politics.
Yeah, it does seem like when you really talk to people one-on-one and break down some of these concepts like socialism, Marxism, it kind of starts to crumble their ideas of it and, you know, you can really get across to them. But is that the way out of this kind of stranglehold that we see a lot of conservative media having on Australia? Do we just have to talk to as many people and get their view straight on it? Or is there a way that in Parliament you're going to try attack it from a top-down process as well?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. Like, the reality is that progressive politics at its best is organising with people on the ground. The other thing we're doing at the moment out of the Griffith office is running this free breakfast program in a few schools. And
straight out of the Black Panthers playbook.
Yeah, that's it. So we're doing that and we're running a free meal program. We're going to start free meal programs in the park in areas in the electorate where there's a high proportion of public housing. And, you know, progressive politics at its best in the past was recognizing that we all share more in common than divides us. And our job is to find that common ground and say to people, we might not agree on everything, but what we can agree on is that it's the billionaires and big corporations who are standing in the way of improving our lives, and let's work together to change that. And I think there's parts of the left that have forgotten that that's what made us powerful in the first place. And so we have to do that and get back to that. And we've moved, like, there's a lot of people, like a lot of politics that's moved away from that, and justifiably people felt alienated. So we have to do that again, and we're certainly trying to. And then, yeah, the top down is, I think, just continuing to bang away on those messages until people start to listen, you know, and getting cut through on that, I think, is going to require a bit of talking in Parliament about it. But probably more importantly, it's going to involve actually organising on the ground and chatting to people.
You've got the portfolio for housing and homelessness for the Greens, along with the cost of living and climate change. I think the housing crisis is going to be the biggest issue of this parliamentary term, potentially for a longer period of time as well. The Labor Party has certainly made some grand announcements, but the announcements seem to be a lot more grand than what they're actually proposing to do and what is actually going to happen. There's a lot of fanfare around these announcements. But what are your party calling for to be done differently in regard to housing?
Yeah, so Labor have made this proposal that on the face of it, the media thought, oh, maybe this is good, but it actually will make, at the end of the day, make the housing crisis worse. So basically what Labor want to do is, rather than invest directly in housing, they want to get $10 billion of public money and put it on the stock market through this thing called the Future Fund, which is this like government investment arm. And they say that any returns that this $10 billion makes on the stock market, they'll spend on housing. Except that last year, I would say stupid Future Fund lost money on the stock market. So if they'd started the whole thing last time, it wouldn't have spent any money on housing last year. It would have lost $120 million. So they then say that they rather than invest directly in housing, they're going to subsidize the construction of quote unquote affordable housing and a little bit of social housing. But even if they meet their targets, so their target is over 5 years, which no expert thinks they'll get anywhere near. They claim that their target is 30,000 social and affordable homes over 5 years. The problem is that the shortage in Australia right now of social and affordable housing is around 640,000 homes. And the shortage is going to grow by 75,000 homes over the next 5 years. So their 30,000, which they're not going to meet, but even if they did, in their best case scenario, their 30,000 doesn't even match the increase in the shortage, let alone deal with the principal. And that's before you get to the millions of renters in rental stress. So our point is that, A, you can't have a housing plan that doesn't help renters. And so we want to see a national freeze on rent increases and a big increase to the Commonwealth rent assistance, which is like a supplementary payment lots of people get to help them cover their rent. And we want to see at least $5 billion invested every year directly in building public and affordable housing. And to put $5 billion in perspective, it might sound like a lot of money, but next year alone, the government is going to spend $12 billion in 1 year in tax concessions for property investors. So we think $5 billion is a very modest amount, actually. And that would allow us to start to build the sort of hundreds of thousands of homes we need to tackle the crisis at the same time as freezing rent increases and actually giving renters some relief.
There are so many different moving parts to this issue. You spoke about rental freezes there. From a realistic point of view, obviously all this sort of stuff, you're negotiating with the Labor Party, you're pushing for it, you're calling for it. How realistic do you think a freeze on rental prices are? Obviously, renters around the country are screaming right now. It's chaos. You know, there's 30 people at every single open home for an apartment. Prices are going through the roof, you know, for basically mold-infested shitboxes. But how realistic do you think a rental freeze could be?
So very realistic, actually. I mean, Victoria froze rents during the pandemic, and the federal government in the past has frozen rent increases post World War II, and interestingly, in similar circumstances where post-war-driven inflation and a massive shortage of housing led to this massive spike in rent increases, so the federal government stepped in and froze rents. And down in the ACT, there's already a form of rent control, which is a Greens Labor government there. So we think it's both very possible and extremely necessary. As you said, we are just getting overwhelmed with the number of people writing in saying, I'm in this mold infested shitbox and my landlord wants to pay me to pay an extra $150 a week in rent and I have to move out. And it's getting to the point now where it would be severely negligent of the government not to step in and act. 30% of the country rents. You can't have a situation where basically it's up to a small group of landlords whether or not these people get to stay in their homes. Like, we wouldn't do that with schools or hospitals. So why on earth should we do it with something just as essential?
I mean, the way you talk about it, necessary, easy to achieve, it seems fine in theory. But then when you look at the way that the Labor government and in the past Liberal government have gone about these negotiations, it seems a lot tougher to get it through to them. You know, they're always, the Labor Party will dole out the lines like making the perfect enemy of the good, or saying how the Greens are siding with the Liberals to block their policies. How do you go into these negotiations with Labor or the Liberals when they were in Parliament, when they seem so kind of ideologically against things like rent freezes or for climate change not opening new fossil fuel plants?
Yeah, great question. And you're right, that's the thing, they roll out the perfect be the enemy of the good. I saw someone on Twitter point out that's like, if the Greens do have a perfect policy, it'd be odd if you didn't approve it. You know, like, seems like they've happened on the perfect policy. Seems like maybe you should agree with it, which I thought was amusing. But the thing is that in these negotiations, because Labor need our support in the Senate now to pass their housing bill. Our point at the moment is that their bill will make the housing crisis worse. Like, it's not, if there was a bill on the table that was like a good, meaningful step in the right direction, but didn't go the whole way, of course we'd be happy to support that in good faith. But the situation is they want to do nothing for renters, cut housing funding in real terms every year and see the shortage of housing grow. So firstly, our message to Labor is come to the table and at least let's get something that starts to fix things, not make it worse. But the other thing is that, you're right that ideologically the biggest barrier is that Labor seems and the Liberals seem ideologically opposed to any meaningful structural reform to fix the housing crisis. And that's before you get to phasing out negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions, which need to go as well. I think where my hope comes from again is what needs to start to shift is renters and people in the suffering the worst of the housing crisis, from my view, also need to start getting organised. And so the other thing we're doing at the same time is we're starting to run these big door knocks again and these big town halls and getting people involved and organised. So I think probably for that sort of big political change to happen as well, politicians from the Labor and Liberal Party start to need, going to have to start to feel that people in their own electorates are getting pretty frustrated with them as well. So that needs to shift as well. But I think you're right. I mean, like, it's not a technical barrier to doing any of this. It's a ideological political opposition which we need to overcome. But certainly we're not going to just roll over and support something that makes the housing crisis worse. We, you know, almost 2 million people voted for us, a lot of them renters, to go down there and fight for them. And my view is you don't just go down there and be an extra arm of the Labor Party and vote for whatever they propose.
It does seem like we are one of the only, you know, major developed cities in the world, in the modern world, that kind of deal with issues this bad around housing. Are you looking to other countries and other situations for inspiration of how to deal with this issue?
Absolutely. And that's the frustration, right? Like, that we're not proposing anything that's never been done before. All we're proposing are things that have been done around the world. So to give you a really good example, there's some Europe, as always, a lot of European countries often do it better than Scandinavian ones. Austria, right? Let's give you an example. So in a city in Austria, say Vienna, 60% of people live in some form of rent-subsidized social housing. But this is like university, everything from university professors and bankers all the way down to people on low incomes. Now, the other thing they've done is rather than build a lot of homes via for-profit developers, the city sort of helps regulate and build this sort of medium density, beautifully designed housing that a lot of people want to live in. And the reason it works is because rather than lots of rents and profits going in the direction of property developers and banks, you know, Commonwealth Bank just made $5.5 billion of profit this year, the increase largely off people paying more on their mortgages. Incomes are instead paid to these organizations that invest back in housing. And so you have this situation where people's rents or their ownership of their homes, that money, instead of going to profit margins, goes back into investing in more housing. And so Austria has really low rates of housing stress. Private housing is some form rent controlled, but also they've got these hundreds of thousands of beautifully designed homes. You know, childcare centers integrated at the bottom, rooftop gardens. They plan the cities really effectively. And so that's done in places like Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, where you build enormous amounts of good quality homes. You rent them out not just to the most vulnerable, but to middle and upper income as well to get a good social mix and good success in neighborhoods. And you also have things like rent control as well. And you certainly don't have massive tax.
It's looked at it as a positive for society, not a burden. It's something that benefits everybody.
Yeah, they don't really have op-ed pieces in their national newspapers calling that stuff communism. Or maybe I just haven't seen
that. I don't
know.
Do you read the Vienna Express?
I read the Vienna Express almost daily. Yeah. So yeah, I haven't seen any of them.
Good to have another Vienna expert in the room.
The thing that I find interesting about that, we don't hear a lot about places like Austria or Singapore. They're more of an ownership model based on a 99-year lease system of houses. But as you said, there are places around the world that have fixed issues like this or avoided issues like we have. But when you look at somewhere, say like Vienna or Singapore, it isn't exactly like a downtown Pyongyang or a downtown Havana. Austria is one of the most well-off countries in the world, one of the most livable countries in the world. Things are pretty good there. People live pretty well, and there is a high amount of wealth within Austria itself. But they've looked at this as a solution to the housing crisis, and everybody seems to be okay with it.
Yeah, big time. And it's sort of a rational thing, right? Like, even from a business perspective, one of the things I get told in the electorate all the time is like, oh, I'm struggling to find workers at the moment because they can't afford to live anywhere near where my business is. Like, even childcare centres, like, they say their biggest issue is that no one can afford to live anywhere near the lift. So from a government planning perspective, it sort of makes an enormous amount of, well, does make an enormous amount of sense to be like, hey, in a wealthy country, we should make sure that everyone has a good, affordable place to call home so we don't ever have a shortage of workers. If people are spending less income covering their rent or mortgage payment, that means they're spending more money at local businesses, they're more money going to the shops, more money going on holidays, you know, bumping up tourism. Like, it's also just really dumb from an economic perspective to force people to spend sometimes the majority of their income on rents or mortgages. Like, Commonwealth Bank doesn't need more money. And if a portion of their $5 billion profit instead went to being spent on going to the local cafe or, like, you know, going on a holiday, then that seems like a more, from a broad economic perspective, seems like a smarter way of doing things.
It is definitely frustrating to see, you know, such easy looking solutions in other parts of the world where so many people are suffering here. Yeah, just before we wrap up in a second, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what Brisbane's going to go through in the next decade. A lot going on. There's the Olympics locked in for 2032 and some plans to renovate the Gabba. But do you think that these are the things that the government should be focusing on, or should all the energy and resources really be directed to important things like getting the Broncos back to their former glory?
Yeah, that's it, or making sure the Brisbane Lions finally win a flag. Yeah, well, I mean, a real failure of the government not to do that either. God knows what's coming with the Broncos.
I'm sure that was one of the main points when you were door knocking, was people saying, yep, let's get the Broncos back to winning premierships.
That's it. Let's get Wayne Bennett back to the Broncos. And why is he at the Dolphins? And, you know, why did they push him
Wayne
out?
Wouldn't be letting these players go on podcasts, talk shit about him, I don't think.
No, that's exactly right. He'd have rule with an iron fist. But, yeah, look, I mean, the Olympics is, yeah, this is, for your listeners that don't know, like, one of the things that they want to do for the Olympics, like, the federal and state government have just announced $7 billion they're going to spend on infrastructure, like stadiums and stuff, you know, which in the middle of a cost of living and housing crisis does seem a little bit mad. But one of the more destructive things they want to do is spend $2.7 billion demolishing and rebuilding the Gabba Stadium for an extra 5,000 seats. Like, literally, it'll be an extra 5,000 seats. And in the process, destroy a local school, local public school, East Brisbane State School, and park, and it's much loved Raymond Park, next to the Pineapple Hotel, for those who know that area. This, I think, is where a lot of people get fed up with politics, because you can't, on the one hand, say there's not enough extra money for housing or, you know, say dental into Medicare, and on the other hand, turn around and say, oh, we're going to spend $2.7 billion demolishing and rebuilding a stadium for 5,000 seats. Like, from our perspective, that is just an insane waste of money. So, yeah, I mean, they should be focusing on housing and finding another super coach for the Broncos.
The two main issues in Queensland and in Brisbane.
That's some real Sydney behaviour, demolishing stadiums to rebuild ones that are very similar to it and spending billions of dollars doing
paying
it.
Overs. Yep. Yeah.
Max Chandler-Mather, thanks very much for joining the show today. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Look forward to seeing you down in Brisbane. We'll pop into one of those pub-up offices that you've got going down there and have a beer and have a chat. But thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Cheers,
great to
thank
have
you.